Welcome to The Bookshow with me, Sinead Gleeson. Get in touch by email bookshow@rte.ie or find us on Twitter and Facebook at bookshowrte. On the show this week, we talk to Pulitzer Prize-winning author of Middlesex, The Virgin Suicides and The Marriage Plot, Geoffrey Eugenides.
The whole idea of becoming a literary artist really, you know, infected me when I was too young to resist or to really know. It was a kind of idealization of the writer.
And do you reread books? And if so, what do you get out of them second time around? I talked to Carlo Gebler about the benefits of rereading.
It's like food. It changes you. And that's why, you know, you should try not to read too much junk, just like you shouldn't eat too much junk.
But first, the Costa Novel Prize was announced this week and was won by Kate Atkinson for Life After Life. And Kate joins me now on the line. Congratulations, Kate.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
How has your week been since the win?
My week has been good, actually. I've been being congratulated a lot. It's always very nice to be congratulated all week.
And tell me, for anybody who hasn't read Life After Life, the book is an unusual book in that it's multiple stories and we meet a character who's been reborn lots of times. Tell me a little bit about Ursula Todd.
Well, Ursula is born in 1910 in a snowstorm and dies almost immediately. I'm not giving any plot away here. And then is born again in exactly the same circumstances, 1910 snowstorm, lives a little bit longer, dies, and so it goes on. She lives a little longer each time, and in each new life, which always starts 1910, February, snowstorm, she rectifies previous mistakes in previous lives, but then makes new mistakes because she doesn't understand what's happening to her. She just thinks she has a massive case of déjà vu until she begins to have a feeling that she understands and realizes that she could change things because she has a horrible war and loses her brother, and she feels that if she could go back, she could perform that greatest cliche of all, which is to kill Hitler before the war. So again, I'm not giving plot away because she tries to do that in the very first page.
So she does learn from these multiple destinies. It's not as though it's a clean slate for her. She's picking up, and it's an accrual.
She does learn, but in a way that to her indicates that I think she's mad because she doesn't understand. And even if she did understand and thought, oh, I know, I'm being born again and again, then she would think she was mad anyway, wouldn't she? So she's quite disturbed as a child.
And probably because you put her through an awful lot of pretty awful things in the book, some terrible things happened to her.
Grim time of it.
what is it about? What was it about Hitler that you wanted to include in the book as a character?
Well, he faded as I wrote the book more, so he became less of a character. I had intended him to be more of a character, but really, I came to him through Eva Braun, his mistress, and which was an interesting back door because he gives us a more domesticated version of Hitler, as it were. He gives us the flatulent, ignorant, lazy Hitler, not the charismatic Hitler who obviously bewitched a large part of Germany. So I think it was interesting to do that. It was odd. I hadn't really intended to, and then suddenly I just saw everything I was reading about Hitler. He just seemed so unattractive. I mean, now we look at him and we think, oh my God, how could people have ever thought that was a charismatic leader? But, you know, at the time it was extraordinary. He was extraordinarily powerful. So I came to him through a way in which he wasn't powerful. But he's sort of confined to one chapter now, really.
And that idea, though, of recurrence in the book, which is essentially Ursula's life, what prompted you to write and tell the story in that way?
Oh, Lord. People always ask you what your starting point for a novel was, and I can never, ever remember. It was more the structure that was attracting me, the idea of, for a long, 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 long time, at the back of my mind, I've had a book, a kind of parallel lives book, where the same thing happens, but differently. And so this just seemed to, when I knew I wanted to write a book about the Second World War, or at least where most of it was set in the Second World War, the two suddenly came together in a way I hadn't expected, in a way that was very neat, actually.
And do you think it relates to some of the characters in your previous work in terms of the idea of predestination or fate or things happening for a reason?
Oh, Lord, that's a huge question.
Sorry.
I don't think so. I mean, it's difficult, isn't it, with fiction, because everything in fiction is predestined by, you know, the God who is the author. So, but other characters, I think a lot of my characters especially Jackson Brodie, the detective, tend to find himself simply hapless and adrift. And I suppose that's how we all feel about life, because you never know what's going to happen when you walk out the door. So I think in that sense, I think characters in fiction are all in the sway of fate, aren't they?
They are indeed. And I think a lot of people will be hearing your name in connection with this Costa Win and Life After Life. But there are a huge number of Jackson Brodie fans out there. You've written a number of books featuring him. Do you think we'll hear from him again?
I think we will. I think I need to recover from him because I got a bit bored with him. But he, yes, no, he's, if I've, you know, if I'm spared, I have another Jackson Brodie somewhere in the future.
Kate Atkinson, again, congratulations on your Costa win for Life After Life, and thanks for talking to us.
Thank you very much.
And best wishes for the overall announcement of the Costa Prize, which takes place later this month on January 28th. And so, from rebirth in Kate Atkinson's Life After Life to being reborn sexually in Jeffrey Eugenides' Middlesex. Eugenides is an American writer of Greek and Irish extraction. He read for the book show from his Pulitzer Prize-winning novel Middlesex, about a hermaphrodite coming to term with adolescence.
I was born twice. First, as a baby girl, on a remarkably smogless Detroit day in January of 1960, and then again as a teenage boy in an emergency room near Petoskey, Michigan, in August of 1974. Specialized readers may have come across me in Dr. Peter Luce's study, Gender Identity in 5 Alpha Reductase Pseudohermaphrodites, published in the Journal of Pediatric Endocrinology in 1975. Or maybe you've seen my photograph in Chapter 16 of the now sadly outdated Genetics and Heredity. That's me on page 578, standing naked beside a height chart with a black box covering my eyes.
Jeffrey Eugenides there, reading from Middlesex. I met with him recently to talk about his 3 hugely successful novels, The Virgin Suicides, Middlesex, and The Marriage Plot, written over a 20-year period. I started by asking him about the manuscripts that he's discarded.
I've always been much too lenient with myself in not publishing things and throwing it away. I'm quite happy to throw work away, and I have lots and lots of unpublished material. As I get older, I begin to my regrets begin to increase, and the idea that I don't have a lot of time left gets a little sharper. But I don't mind. I don't want to bother anyone or take anyone's time with something I don't think is any good or ready to be read.
Are you tempted to go back and try and salvage anything? I know Kevin Barry has spoken about trying to create these Frankenstein stories of bits of old stories and, you know, weld them all together. Do you ever have that temptation?
I have the temptation, but usually, you know, Frankenstein, that whatever electricity you need to animate the dead creature is no longer available. So it's, you know, it's impossible. You really need something new. The ideas repeat all the time, of course, as with any writer. You're constantly writing the same story or a version of the same story, but it needs to have a kind of different energy in it.
You are also that rare thing in that your books are considered very literary, but they sell quite well. And then obviously Oprah championed your work, and some writers have had issues with that idea of, like, mass appeal. How do you feel about sort of straddling the two?
You know, you are far away from any idea of readership or popularity when you're writing. You're just concerned with the book. So when you finish it, what happens is what happens. And I don't think a writer should take too big a stand, or have, you know, you try not to have a strong reaction one way or another. If a book doesn't sell, you have to take that with a certain amount of stoicism. And in a sense, you have to have the same kind of distance, even if it turns out to be popular beyond what you expected. Most writers would probably be lying if they said they would rather be unread than read. My literary agent said that she's represented a lot of writers over the years, and she says the only writer who never expects his books to sell is William Gass. He's the only one. Everyone else, I don't care how experimental they are or avant-garde, they all secretly think this one's gonna be the big smash. So I think I'm just like anyone else in that. You know, you always think, you write a book, you hope people read it.
Do you get fearful coming up to the time when a book's about to come out? Do you start to panic slightly?
It's a difficult time, and you do panic. You have different strategies. This last book, I had two writer friends, both Jonathan Franzen and Jhumpa Lahiri, told me, don't read reviews, which had always seemed an impossible task. How could you not? So this last time, I didn't read any reviews. I tried to. It's hard with the internet. They pop up in front of you, or someone calls you and tells you, sorry about that review in The Economist. So it's a little difficult to hide, but you have strategies for that, and the strategies are there because of the anxiety, of course. You've been working many years on something, and it can, you know, it can be quite wounding to be pummeled.
We're talking to you here in New York, and we've come from Dublin, and Dublin obviously is where James Joyce comes from, and he's somebody that has, I think, loomed large for you in New York.
Maybe too large. He was the reason I wanted to become a writer, is reading Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man. I had a friend whose father, they were all Irish, I'm half Irish, but they were pure Irish American, and talked about Joyce a lot, and they seemed very literary and impressive. And then we started reading Joyce together, my friend and I, and the whole idea of becoming a literary artist really, you know, infected me when I was too young to resist or to really know. It was a kind of idealization of the writer. The whole priestly idea of the writer that you find in Joyce and that you find in the modernists appealed to me very, very much. The idea of a vocation, even a life of self-abnegation and scarcity, but with intense feeling and moments of ecstasy that are achieved through long solitary labor. That appealed to me then. It actually still appeals to me, though I have a much less heroic idea of it.
The way you describe that sounds like exactly like Joyce got it from the Jesuits, I think.
I think so. I think it's, you know, it's like Jesuits, but you get to drink a bit. So it sounded good to me when I was 17.
Joyce was obviously hugely influenced by Dublin as a place. What was it like for you growing up in Detroit? Because you've written about it as a city and its impact on you.
I did, and now everyone is talking about Detroit. It's kind of amazing. When I first wrote, you know, there's a city that's not named in The Virgin Suicides, but it's definitely Detroit. And there hadn't been that many books about Detroit. So the first thing I knew is that it was undiscovered territory in the main. And that's something that a writer's looking for. If you write about New York, you're competing against everyone. But not too many people had written about Detroit. And also, I knew that it was an amazing city whose history went out in many different directions, culturally, in terms of, obviously, the automobile,
and music.
Even and definitely music, race problems. A lot of the things, you know, that are bedeviling America forever, you can find them in Detroit. So I didn't need to go anywhere else to be able to write about the United States. And now people are quite interested in the problems of urbanization. And even in Germany, they have it's not an institute, but it's about shrinking cities. What do you do when a city shrinks? And Germany's had to deal with this in the East with a lot of the cities that are kind of dying out. So it even connects with Europe to a certain extent.
You include a lot of references to other books and to writers in the marriage plot. Is that a kind of homage, or why did you want to let literature sort of make its own way into the book?
The marriage plot is about about reading and how dangerous reading can be. I just told you I became a writer because of reading James Joyce. So I'm quite aware that what you read, especially at an impressionable age, can alter your life's course. I think this also happens for many people in terms of romance, who they think about, that they think about romance, finding the soulmate, finding the one person to love. A lot of that comes from reading romantic stories or seeing the movies that are based on those. So in order to talk about how reading affects us, and that reading is really not something that's a sideline, but in a way it courses through us and it alters our behavior. And in order to do that, I had to necessarily talk about a lot of different writers. It wasn't an idea that I'm going to write a book dropping names and talking about Jane Austen or George Eliot. It's just that these people are in college, and what I remember about college is books and talking about books. These things were almost like drugs that you ingested.
The first line is, to start with, look at all the books. Are opening lines and opening pages and opening chapters something that you spend an awful lot of time on?
I do, because I think it's like introducing yourself to someone. You might want to make a good impression. People's attention is necessarily divided, especially nowadays. So you want an opening line that will, you know, be of interest to the reader. But more importantly than that, a beginning tells me what the book is. So I work a long time before I get my first paragraph, because you work in a lot of doubt when you're writing a novel and you're not sure if you can do it. But the first paragraph, if it's there, and it in a way contains all the elements that the book is going to be, it's your touchstone. You can go back to it and and say, okay, that's what this book is, when you start to lose your way.
Do you feel the same about endings? I know that John Irving, and I think Joseph Heller as well, said that they literally couldn't write something until they knew what the last line was. Is that anything you can relate to?
No, I'm the opposite of that kind of writer. If I were to come up with an ending for a book, it would be a formulaic ending. I don't see how you come up with a surprising ending not having written the book and lived with the book moment to moment. So as I write a book, I will see the different possibilities of where it could go, and those possibilities will be more interesting than what I could have known or just imagined when I was writing the first pages. So I have to leave myself open to serendipity and chance and second thoughts or third thoughts while I'm writing. And to me, that's the only way that a book starts to resemble the surprisingness of life. I don't want them to be too planned. I want them to make sense. But you have to live in a lot of, that's where a lot of anxiety can happen in writing, because you're in the middle of the forest, you don't know which way to go.
And that was Jeffrey Eugenides. If you want to read some of Eugenides' recent writing, The New Yorker magazine published a short story of his in November called Find the Bad Guy. The Virgin Suicides, Middlesex and The Marriage Plot are all still widely available. Now, usually at this time of year, people decide they're going to read a stack of new books in the following year and make all sorts of rash promises to themselves. But what about re-exploring some of the books you've already read over the years? We asked some readers about the books they have reread.
There's a series by Elizabeth Jane Howard called The Cazalet Chronicles. She used to be married to Kingsley Amis, and she then wrote a really long saga about her family life from just before World War II up until the 60s. So before the fifth book came out, I read the previous four again just to kind of read myself back into the family saga. So yeah, I would reread a lot.
I suppose there aren't very many books, particularly novels, that I've gone back to. The only one that I can recall is The Great Gatsby, which might be obvious, but I don't know, it just seems like an easy one to go back to, and it's also, you get something new from it every time you read it, and it's got such memorable lines, particularly obviously the opening and the last couple of lines. And obviously it's been highlighted in the last year or two with the movie, the Baz Luhrmann's movie out, and I think I must have read it this stage maybe 6 or 7 times.
I mean, I think books that I probably read when I was a lot younger have come back to me. One of the books in particular was The Diary of Anne Frank. It's a book I read actually when I was only 15 years old, I think around probably the same age that Anne Frank herself was when she wrote the diary. And I think the thing that really struck me about the diary is all the way through it, you know, she mentions how she wanted to be a writer, but that she really didn't think she was good enough, or she wasn't talented enough.
There are no books that I reread. I feel like rereading is betraying the books that I could read in favour of books that I've already read. And I know there's different arguments in favour of rereading, and I really have some sympathy with them. There are some books that I really like to reread. For instance, I've been given some consideration to rereading all the Terry Pratchett books I read as a kid, because I feel now I'd get a lot more out of them than I did then. So there's a very big temptation.
The His Dark Materials trilogy, and it's something that I read when I was 12. My mom is an English teacher, and she used to test books out on me, and she wanted me to read it, and I read it quite reluctantly, I have to say. And then I've reread it probably in my 20s and now in my 30s, and every time I have found something new in it, and I've enjoyed introducing it to other people as well. So yeah, it would have to be The His Dark Materials, especially Northern Lights, the first one, I think, by Philip Pullman, which is the one I revisit most.
And great to hear so many people rereading books they came across as teenagers. I talked about the benefits of rereading with writer Carlo Gebler, and as well as being an author, Carlo is also a writer in residence at McGabry Prison, where he gets the chance to reread with the book club there.
I mean, there's a book club every 2 weeks, so that means I'm reading 24 books or so a year, and a lot of the books are books that I've already read. Not always, but often. I mean, such things as To Kill a Mockingbird, L.P. Hartley's The Go-Between, Robert Graves' Goodbye to All That, Animal Farm, George Orwell, and there's a very long list. Books which I read when I was at school or in my 20s, and I'm now rereading.
Why do we reread novels when, in many instances, you know, Animal Farm being one, we remember the plot vividly, we know what happens, so mm-hmm. why go back?
When you read a book, it alters the makeup of your psyche. It changes you. You're a slightly different person at the end of reading a book to what you were at the beginning. It's like food. It changes you, and that's why, you know, you should try not to read too much junk, just like you shouldn't eat too much junk. So when you read a book, you come to it through a sort of cloud of exegesis, the things that you are told about it. So in the case of Animal Farm, when I did it at O level in 1968, all the exegesis was about what Orwell was saying about the history of the Soviet Union and the fate of the Trotskyists and how revolutions are always betrayed. So it was impossible to approach the book except through Russian politics. Reread the book all those years later, you see, yes, it is about those things, but you also see, which I failed to see when I first read it, that it is a brilliant folk tale. It works completely on its own terms as an account of some things that happen to these imaginary animals who talk and act and behave like human beings. But it's, you know, that it's not a conventional folk tale, but it works as a folk tale, and that's quite extraordinary. But you wouldn't have known that had you not gone back to it.
There are particular books that seem to be reread, maybe things like Tolkien or Harry Potter. In fact, a lot of sci-fi and fantasy. Do particular genres lend themselves to rereading, do you think?
No, I think anything can be reread, and reread with benefit. I mean, I was very struck when I reread To Kill a Mockingbird. The first time I read it, I read a book that was a book about, you know, a little man, a small man, a powerless man doing something good. He doesn't necessarily succeed, but he does the right thing. The second time I read it as an absolute account, I mean, a devastating account of the fact that the United States of America is irreformable. You cannot change the basic DNA of a country that is as warped and awful as America is.
So we are definitely in danger of missing things first time around.
Absolutely. There's a wonderful, there's a long, long passage in Proust, in Remembrance of Things Past, which is a very long book, unfortunately. And he talks about when somebody, he's talking, Swan, one of the characters, talking about painters. And he thinks about a man who paints cloudscapes, and everyone looks at the clouds and they go, "What? Those don't look like clouds. What is this painter doing? This is terrible. That man is blind." And then gradually, and Proust uses the analogy of the spectacles, something happens, lenses change. And then one day, someone puts on the spectacles and they look at the bad painter's cloudscapes and they go, "Oh my God, he's a genius. How come I never saw it before?" That's exactly how the clouds look. But Proust's point is it takes time to fit yourself into what the book, it sometimes takes time to fit yourself to accommodate what the book is trying to say. And that's another reason why you should reread, because sometimes first time round you don't get it.
But what about the other extreme? I was speaking to a friend this week who's a writer, and he recalls reading The Plague by Camus as a teenager and devouring it, and he said when he went back as an adult, he just went, "This is ridiculous."
Oh, you mean it's too cardboard and too...
Absolutely.
..too on the button. Camus actually is a person who I've reread with value and with pleasure, but I do think that The Plague does seem very overtly symbolic, and it wears its meaning on its sleeve. And probably it isn't a book that rewards rereading in the same way that A Happy Death or The Fall or The Outsider by Camus reward rereading.
Donna Tartt said recently in the New York Times by the book, which is a great section which gives you an insight into what writers like to read, that she said she always has a comfort book on the go, and she picked Raymond Chandler's The Big Sleep. Is there something comforting about going back to a book? A sense of solace, maybe?
No. Well, in my case, no. I don't have anything that comforts me by returning to it. Often, actually, returning to a book is a chastening and humiliating experience, because you read something and you think, "What was I thinking? I was asleep when I read this first time round. I only took about 2% of this book on board. How stupid was I?" So what you do is you meet an older self and you discover how wanting you were.
And this relates, I think, to what people were saying in the box we heard there about rereading particularly childhood books and all the things that you didn't get the first time around, or that have adult themes that you couldn't relate to when you were younger.
Yeah, well, we in the book club in McGabry, we reread The Go-Between, which is about a young boy who becomes the postman. He takes love letters between a posh upper-class woman and a farmer. And it's a book about hypocrisy and lies and the class system. And it's a fantastic book. But when I read it at 16, no, I didn't get I sort of knew it was about that, but I could not possibly understand it. I was not mature enough.
But why do you think that, say, young children, very young children, like to hear the same bedtime story over and over again? There's something in the repetition.
That's a different point. That's to do with context, isn't it? Mm. I mean, I was read by my mother. We had the Rosemary O'Sullivan Irish folk tales, and she used to read them all, but particularly The Children of Lear, which is a very, very bleak story. And I remember the first time I heard it and realising, what? They have to stay 9 times 99 years as swans? They don't get back to be human again? And it was a devastating realisation that there was not a happy ending, a useful thing to learn. And yet, the repetition of the reiteration, you know, the human voice bringing that story through the ear into the soul was something that I needed over and over and over again. It's water, and it gradually smooths the pebbles of your character.
If you had to pick a book that you changed your mind extremely about, whether that was for good reasons or for bad reasons, and rereading, what would it be?
I think probably anything by Chekhov. Chekhov, first time round, looks... He's insouciant. He's just chucked these things out. You know, a man talks to a woman, they have a walk, you know, they kiss, that's it. It's nothing. But when you reread it, you realise that underneath this incredibly simple and thrown together surface, there's fantastic depth and meaning and feeling and tenderness for human beings and their suffering.
I'm somebody who's ardently not a rereader, mainly for time reasons, but am I missing out by not rereading?
Yes. On the other hand, I also understand that time is very precious. I mean, I think the thing is that one has to learn, gulp, to read faster.
Well, I'm certainly reading as fast as I can. Thanks there to Carlo Gebler. Finally tonight, for anyone out there who has a manuscript lying around the house or one they've possibly been working on for a while, RTE Television's The Today Show is running a competition, Get Your Novel Published, in conjunction with publishers New Ireland. Now, entrants have a fairly narrow window to submit their work. It's between 4 p.m. this Friday, January 10th, and ends midnight Sunday, January 25th. All you have to do is submit a 500-word synopsis and your first 50-page sample to editor@newireland.ie, but put competition submission in the subject line. That's all we've time for this week. Thanks for tuning in. Keep an eye on the website for any items you might want to listen back to at rte.ie. The programme was produced by Zoe Cummins. Noel Roberts was on sound.